pussycat, pussycat. I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat know. What's new, pussycat?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway for Sunday, October 9, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Michael Portantier and Jan Simpson. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Jan Simpson. Jan is the co-director of the Arts and Culture Journalism Program at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism and also writes for TDF Stages and Playbill. Good morning, Jan.
Morning.
Peter is traveling, I forget, he's in North Dakota or something like that today. So we were trying to work out logistics to have him join us, but I just couldn't make it work, so he will be back with us next week. With us today, we have a very special guest. Richard Greenberg is joining us by phone, and he is with us. And Broadway fans will know that Richard has written 24 plays, including the Tony Award-winning Take Me Out, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, as was his play 3 Days of Rain. He is the winner of Newsday's George Oppenheimer Award for Best New Playwright and the Penn Laura Pels Award for Playwright in Mid-Career. Richard, thanks for getting up on a Sunday morning, on a lousy Sunday morning, isn't it? It's cold and rainy.
It's the kind I love best.
Oh, really?
No, this is the weather I pray for. Yes.
You can work?
I've got, it's an answer prayer, there is a God.
Does this inspire 3 Days of Rain, maybe 4 Days of Rain?
Yes. You did cite 3 Days of Rain, and that's, the title came before the idea for the play because I just, it represented all I wanted from life.
Well, we're here this morning a little bit to talk about if I can call it a manifesto, rules for others to live by, Common Sense Self-Contradictions by Richard Greenberg, which is a new book that you it was just out this week, isn't it?
It is the first book that started as a book that I've ever written.
Really? Oh, so
yeah,
you know, what? Why did you sit down and say, you know, certainly you have so much on your plate. Why did you say I need to write a book?
My agent told me to. That sounds really strange. It started with him. It was his idea. It came out of the blue, although I don't think it was so much out of the blue for him because it sounded very prepared when he mentioned it to me, and I rejected it immediately because it would be a book of personal essays, which meant it would be personal, and I'm the least confiding person I know. So I thought, I can't do that. I can't. But then the idea stuck with me, and I figured out a way I could do it, and then I started.
Well, that is, it's so interesting because your book is such a collection of personal insights, and you say that you don't confide. I was just doing some research on you, and,
okay.
And in one of the interviews that you gave a number of years ago, you said, every interview I've given is a pack of lies. So defend that.
Defend that it's a pack of lies? I think that's the one statement that doesn't need defending.
Well, usually when somebody says, my agent tells me I need to write a book, it means that you're about to run for office. This is true?
Oh, I'm yes. In fact, this is a campaign memoir.
It's a kickoff.
No, I will not be. I will be running from office. I will not be running for office. I run from every office I ever pass. It's funny because I started, and the way I figured out to do it was I decided that I would treat the character called I as just another version of the characters in my plays that everyone always assumes are based on me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and in a way it allowed me to get closer to the factual me because I felt such a distance from him. That just sounds garbled, but it is raining and it's Sunday morning, and this is the first conversation I've had. And when I started writing, I realized that all I ever do is write essays. I just don't write them down. That when I'm alone at home, which I am a lot, I just make sentences, and the sentences form paragraphs, and the paragraphs are consecutive, and I drive toward a conclusion. And that's what I do walking around. It's sort of my default mode. So that the first several essays I wrote, I discovered I'd already written. I just needed to transcribe them.
Oh. One of the loveliest is the chapter about Jill Clayburgh.
Oh, thank you, Jill. Yeah, yeah. You know, there was a thing. I have several friends, women friends, who did die, I would say, early. Not, they weren't all young by strictest standards, but that was all early. And I realized when I started this book, this would be a chance to talk about them directly.
So you also write about your beloved neighborhood Chelsea in New York City, and when did you put this book to bed? Was it a couple of months ago? Was it more than a couple of months ago?
I guess. Oh my gosh! You see, this is these are the questions I can never answer. When did you start? When did you finish? Where did you get the idea? The idea, I don't know.
It's well, the reason
like
that
a
I asked.
Fairy came at night. I don't know. But when did, I guess it must have been, a few months ago by now, because there's a sort of long period where the thing has to be locked.
Yeah. The reason that I ask is that we know that 3-4 weeks ago there was that attempted terrorist attack in Chelsea, right in your neighborhood, and I wondered how that would have, if you would have had another essay in the book about that.
I might have, and then I started when it happened. I mean, we're also not all of us, but we do see things from our own windows, I suppose. And I thought, well, a sequel. The thing is, I mean, you've probably spoken to a lot of people who live here about that attack, and it's almost funny the way people talk about it. Because, first of all, remember, the big controversy was whether, in fact, it was Chelsea or the Flatiron District. That was really the major topic of discussion after it happened. Once everybody found out that everyone had been released from the hospital, they thought, oh, well, then why are we still talking about this? I mean, I don't know if this is a sign of how dowdy we all are or how jaded and benumbed we all are, but that's what was going on. And then people were really going on, threads, whatever. I don't do any of that, but I read about it. So just saying, well, really, you know, guys, it's not Chelsea, it's Flatiron. And then I thought about it. I thought, well, if it was midway down the block, I think that counts as Chelsea. Because if you're as close to 7, because I think 7th and 23rd really is Chelsea. 6th, yeah. Yes, I see what you're saying. So this is how we do terror attacks now in my neighborhood.
Well, and then the other thing that was funny was that when it turned out that the second bomb was found by two guys who found it and then stole the bag, and then someone tweeted, New Yorkers don't mess with us, we're nuts.
Yes.
I remember, yes, and somebody talked about the things that really terrify us, and there were the livings, and was like there were bed bugs, and I mean it was, and then like the 265 terrorist attack. It's I don't know. They say that famous dictum, all history happens twice, first as tragedy, then as farce. I just didn't expect farce to come so soon.
Yeah. So, Richard, you and I share something that we were born and grew up and lived off the Babylon line, and we're going to talk about that for a second.
What town? Where were you?
Amityville. I was born in Amityville. And,
So you were toward the end, Amityville, Copaig,
yes,
Lindenhurst, Babylon.
You know the Long Island Railroad. Yes, exactly.
I know that line. I haven't taken it probably in 15 years, but I can pretty much recite it.
Yeah, no, you being an East Meadow High School graduate you're returning here to write about the Babylon line. Is this a personal thing, or is this a work of fiction that you have developed?
Well, you know what, this was, let's see, I would say I think they're all personal in some way. I have a sort of, it's a hobgoblin for me, what people consider autobiography, because I think what is considered autobiography generally is gossip, which means, did that very thing happen? Where I think autobiography, it should include everything you think about and brood about and dream about. And so in that way, yes, it's autobiographical. Also, it's always so helpful to have material to hand. And this was, you know, this was a place I lived for 18 years straight through and kept visiting for another 25 or so. So I wanted to go back to it. I also wanted to go back to it because I wanted to write about the suburbs in a certain kind of way, because I've found the typical evocation of the suburbs, both the utopian and dystopian versions, not reflective of my experience. And I thought, well, you know, I can go at this from my own approach and from my own experience. And also, I knew when I was growing up, I had a friend whose mother adored living in East Meadow. Now, this was only one person, I realize, so we can't generalize. But the thing about her, she was smart, she was funny, she was fun, she was great to be around. She was sort of, you know how many of us, when we grow up, we have both our own parents, whom we love, and our parents of election, who are the parents of our friend we like best. She was the mother of the friend I like best. And she had a great time on these streets in this town at those diners. And I wanted to just tell a story that included her.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is the Babylon Line for listeners. That's you didn't miss it because it's coming up. The preview is beginning November 10th, and you are in the thick of it right now, aren't you?
We just started. Yeah. We just started. Thursday. Thursday.
Rehearsal. You say. Yeah.
Yeah, we just started rehearsal Thursday.
Yeah. So that is.
And this friend of your mother is sort of a central character in the...
Well, you know what? The funny thing is, she was the inspiration for a character, but then what happened is I put the character into antagonistic circumstances so that her mood shifted.
Oh, but she didn't get cut.
She did. Oh, gosh, no. No, but she's put in a position where she has to defend her love of... well, it's Levittown. It wasn't Levittown, but... Same difference. Yeah. Anyway, and so other qualities come out from the ones that she typically showed. But yeah, no. She was one of the sources for it, and I thought, well, why not have someone actually love it there?
You so often write really rich roles for women, and I was wondering, was that a conscious decision or just what naturally interests you?
I have a lot of women friends. I have more friends who are women than who aren't women. It's just very, very natural to write for women. It turns out that I also have been writing. The woman in this play is now, in this production, starting to have a very light but discernible Southern accent, and I almost didn't want to cop to the fact that I'd written this character Southern because I'd done that before, and I thought, oh, I just don't want to be charged with repeating myself as though writing about, you know, a certain region twice would necessarily be repeating yourself, but, you know, you get defensive. But I have a lot of Southern women friends, and I don't know how that happened. Because, you know, I don't travel in the South much, but here they are, and they're my friends, and they're fascinating people, and diverse. And so, though none of them has been a direct model, they've all been influences.
So you talked about that this character from Levittown is perhaps the character married or friends with Bill O'Reilly, who grew up in Levittown as well?
I can say for a fact she is not.
Would not be.
Although the play takes place, by the way, mainly, it sort of travels forward from it, but it takes place mainly in the fall and early winter of 1967. So I think we had already been blessed with Bill by then, but he would have been quite young.
He speaks of his affection for Levittown so often. So.
Oh, does he?
Yes.
Well, I think he was probably, yeah, I think he was the neighbor kid that nobody liked. Yeah, that's who he is in the play. But I'll have to write him in as soon as we hang up.
He still is the neighbor kid nobody likes.
To move away from Bill O'Reilly for a moment.
Thank you.
I was actually out with a friend last night, Richard, and we mentioned the wonderful actor Peter Frechette.
Oh, my gosh, Peter.
Yeah, and was wondering, we hadn't seen him lately. Are you in touch?
I am not in touch, and this is just because life happens. But I believe he is, he's ensconced in, I think the Shakespeare Company, oh, gosh, this involves names. All right. I apologize for any mistakes. But and I think it's in Ashland, Oregon. Am I right?
Ashland,
and I believe he's a member there and working constantly, and from reports I get third hand, really, really happy with that. Because, you know, he's really a theater guy.
Great.
More than anything else. I mean, he is really a creature of the stage.
Wonderful.
So you have, grew up in East Meadow, went off to Princeton University. Right now, according to IBDB, you have 11 Broadway productions to your credit, both as adaptations and as a writer, of course, and many different ways. What was your path to Broadway?
Surprising. You know, by the time I was at drama school, I went to drama. Oh, well, I didn't necessarily intend to be a playwright, but after Princeton, I went to Harvard to a PhD program in English and American literature. And from the day before I left, it was clear I wasn't fated to graduate from that program. I was already academically exhausted. So one day I was due to report on the Henry James novel, The Princess Casamassima, in the course run by my advisor, the next day, and I realized I was halfway through and not paying attention. So I had, for all practical purposes, dropped out of Harvard. But I was in a play, so I was still living in Cambridge. And so I decided, with my free time, of which I had a lot, because I was afraid to go to campus where I might run into my teachers, I wrote a play. And then the next year, I didn't really have anything to do, and all I knew was school. So I sent the play off to Yale. And Yale took me, and that's why I'm a playwright. Really, I wasn't thinking along those lines. And then, while I was at Yale, all right, this is a long answer to a short question, but there you have it. There was a article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about Playwrights Horizons, and on the front page there was a picture of all of their playwrights, and it was this really kind of young, very successful, very impressive bunch, and I thought, I want to be one of those, do you know? And then eventually I did have a play at Playwrights, I mean a few years later, and that had been the sum of my ambition, because you weren't expecting to go to Broadway when you became a playwright during the time I became a playwright.
Yeah.
Broadway was something else, and it didn't even figure into your ambitions. But then I had a play that Frank Rich liked off-Broadway, and it transferred, and all of a sudden I was showing up on Broadway. And it surprised me, and I think I've never I was warned that first time by people. You know, when you're young, people are always trying to intimidate you. And, you know, it's tough out there. You know, old Broadway hand saying it's a different thing, and I was like, it was as if he was trying to induce a nervous breakdown. But I never really had that, because it's always and continues to feel like sort of just a bonus. Do you know that not what you're aiming for or what you're expecting, but this sort of delightful little extra thing that happens sometimes.
Oh, it's we're all so fortunate that it has happened. Quickly before you run, tell us about how how Take Me Out evolved. I mean, were you a baseball fan, a baseball player, or did this just happen to end up in a locker room with a baseball team?
Well, I think it's none of the above, except the first one, belatedly. In fact, I was one of those people who just was, I was one of those people who was always finding ways to schedule a viola lesson during gym class. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Well, I seem to remember, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't you say at the time that basically you were the Dennis O'Hare character?
That's certainly the character that people would think. But I would say that the way he discovered baseball was kind of I was not anyone's business manager, but like him, it was something I paid no attention to. And then the minute I did, it flooded me. And suddenly I realized I had all of these memories that I didn't realize I have, because they were, of course, it was a suburban childhood, and I had a father and I had an older brother and I had cousins on the block. And so this was going on in the background all the time. So it had, and I was just resenting it because I knew it was something I would be bad at. And then just out of boredom, because it was August, and August is a month that undoes me, I don't know what to do with it. And I was really planning to reread Proust. I mean, that's the most pretentious possible thing to say. But I just thought, well, that'll take up August. The six-volume Norwegian novel was far in the future at the time. So I thought, I'll do that. And then the Yankees were in the World Series, and I just flipped it on, and I thought, this is interesting. Do you know, I think it's got a lot of stuff. I no longer resented it. I knew no one was going to not be picking me for the team. And I just thought, why was it I didn't like it? And within, I don't know. Actually, I had watched the World Series. I got this wrong twice and thought that was interesting. Then it was 99 when it was the regular season and I had nothing to do. And I turned it on and I just started watching. And I watched again the next night and then the next night. And then I couldn't stop. And for 6 months, I couldn't think about anything else. And I reevaluated everything in my life as it related to baseball. And I didn't intend to write a baseball play, but I remembered that I was a playwright, and it was my only subject. Hmm. So I did. And I thought, maybe I will later. The good thing that happened, I mean, it was a horrible thing that happened, but I liked it, was that, remember John Rocker?
Yes.
The Atlanta Braves
relief pitcher who
was just a kind of massive bigot, gave that interview at a time when people weren't giving interviews like that so much. And what happened was as opposed to now, where it's sort of, you can't keep track of them anymore. But then it was so shocking. And I had been afraid that if I wrote about baseball, it would be a Valentine. And I don't think those are very good. I think they're kind of gushy and not interesting. And then suddenly I had an idea of an antagonist, and I was able to turn it into a play.
Mm. Hmm. So, many of your works have been highly regarded by Broadway fans and Broadway reviewers and things like that, but you have a whole section in your book about opinions. So Excuse me?
Yes, I just repeated the word.
So the opinion section in your book, how does that square up against Broadway opinions that maybe by professionals like Mr. Brantley, or maybe by snarky person number four on the left on Broadway World?
Well, in the book, I write about how I have given up having opinions, and it's been actually a lovely sort of light feeling to do so. When they meet their maker, they're going to have to square themselves with it. I just find that I don't prescribe. I don't prescribe. That would be sort of a version of an opinion, wouldn't I, if I said you really ought to. The thing about it is that was written late in the book, and I think if I had come to that revelation earlier, I wouldn't have been able to write much of the book. Because it's quite opinionated for a long time, and then suddenly I decided, I'm sick of having these opinions. They're burdensome and they're not working in my favor, and I mean you still have to about politics, so I left that alone. But I just felt I was traveling in a kind of haze or a miasma of opinion, and I was tired of contributing to it, and I started distrusting my own and thinking, these aren't real. This is just me trying to position myself in some way. So I decided to give up having it. I remember shortly after I gave them up, I went to see a play, and it was specifically the first play about which I didn't have an opinion. And it was like my test play. And it was just the nicest feeling as I walked out. I had a friend in it who was absolutely wonderful, and I thought, okay, well, this is kind of an opinion. Well, no, it's just a response. I mean, it was dicey. And all I had to do was say, you know, as I walked out, it was a comedy. I said, it was a quiet house, but I have to say, everything everyone said was really nice. And I could just say that to her because I thought, you know, when you're doing a comedy and the house is quiet, you feel bad. And I thought, I am extracted from this phenomenon. I'm just reporting others. I felt exalted.
But do you think it's just a phase, Richard?
I hope not. It's very hard, you know. It's very hard. You fall back into your habits, and they feel sour. But I'd like to. I mean, what I explain is what I'm trying to. When I say, and I'm giving away the point of the essay, but what the heck? It's to what I'm saying. I'm trying to distinguish between response and verdict. Do you know what I mean? And that's really it. I'm not trying not to respond to things, but I'm trying to remember that because I feel a certain way about a thing, it doesn't mean that that thing should be evaluated in some way. I mean, it's toilet training as much as anything. It's the whole history of my life is doing this, and it doesn't mean that that is a bad or even that that is a good.
I think that's really fascinating, but wouldn't it be difficult since everyone is always demanding a verdict?
Everyone is, and it's really wearing me out. That's one of the reasons that, you know, I would love to say I was countercultural, but maybe I'm just eccentric. I don't know. But I know that this verdictiness of the time we're living in is part of much of what drove me away. Do you know, I'm worn out. It just smacks of self-righteousness, and self-righteousness has very little to do with introspection. So I'm working on it. It's been months and months, maybe a year by now, maybe more. It's been, I think, over a year that I've been squelching my opinions, and I'm still happy.
Well, you might have given away the opinion section of your book, but that was only two or three pages of 300-some-odd of pages in this book. The Rules for Others to Live by Richard Greenberg is available from Blue Rider Press. It was released on October 4th, so it is out there at all your booksellers that you're able to get to and purchase it in the time for holidays. It's an excellent gift to give to everybody. Richard, thank you so much for coming on Broadway Radio and sharing some time with us on your Sunday morning as the Babylon Line is getting ready to get into rehearsal again.
Thanks so much for asking me.
That you don't see the tears, just let me grieve in private, cause each time I see you, I break down and cry. Stop, walk on by. Stop, walk on by.
All right, in our review section, the three of us had the opportunity to see The Encounter, which is a different type of Broadway show. Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, this is the Complicité production of The Encounter, inspired by the book Amazon Beaming by Petru Popescu, conceived, directed, and performed by Simon McBurney. And right from the beginning, everything I heard and read about the show made it sound like it was going to be quite unique. As I'm sure most of our listeners have heard, it involves wearing headphones throughout the performance. And the production uses binaural technology in order to create various sounds of this story, which is, in a nutshell, a recounting of what happened to a photographer named Lauren McIntyre when he became lost in the Amazon in, I believe, 1969. Is that correct?
Around then, yeah.
Yeah, and encountered a local tribe of very very remote tribe, very uncivilized, to use that word. And what happened to him during this experience? And I have to say that as soon as I heard the plot, I thought, well, that sounds really interesting in itself. And so I was quite surprised when I started hearing from some people who saw the show that they really, really did not like it. I wasn't able to imagine how it could not be interesting given the basic situation itself. It certainly sounded like it would be a fascinating story. I should explain a little more about the binaural technology that the play uses. I knew something of it previously. It involves sound being recorded with two microphones that placed on something that simulate a human head. And so what happens is when the sound is played back, if it's done correctly, it creates an incredibly lifelike sensation of sound with a very specific placement of sounds. You would swear that someone is speaking directly behind you or to the left of you or above you or whatever, and you can seem to sense sounds coming from all different spaces. And so this was used, among other things, to recreate the sounds of the Amazon, where this fellow was lost. And that part of it was really quite extraordinary and in itself fascinating. But for me, the problem was, well, first of all, I thought the show started out very well. To me, one of the most entertaining parts was the beginning, where Simon McBurney comes out and explains binaural technology and also give some background to this true story, and he does some banter with the audience, and it was really quite charming and humorous, and I really loved that part. And then when it got into the story itself, the story of Lauren McIntyre, I also found it extremely interesting. The first part where he is dropped off in the Amazon by this pilot that he rented, I guess. And then the pilot takes off and there he is left there and then subsequently becomes lost and discovers this tribe. But I guess for me, the problem was that after that, it seemed to me that the storytelling became very convoluted and also had a lot of tangents, constant tangents that kept taking you away from it. And on top of that, the story started to get into a great deal of metaphysical and symbolic content. And that really lost me. At some point, I started to become very bored and disinterested. And it actually started to seem to me that the running time was considerably longer than the hour and 45 minutes without intermission that was advertised. So I was disappointed because I thought it was a great idea and I thought it started out really well and I thought the binaural technology is fascinating. I don't think it's non-theatrical. Some people are shouting about how it's not a play or whatever. I don't agree with that. I thought that the performance was extraordinary and certainly very theatrical. I don't think that Mr. McBurney stands still for a moment, and he really tries to bring us into the story. But I just had issues with the storytelling itself, and so that was my ultimate disappointment.
All right, Jan, what did you think about it?
I didn't like it as much as Michael did.
Mm. Oh, okay.
That's Peter's line, or Peter and I. Peter and I switch that line back and forth.
Jan is doing an excellent understudy there. Yes.
I agree with you that the idea of the story was probably interesting and probably worked very well as a book, and might have worked well as a movie, so that we could see this, or might have worked well if it had been fully dramatized. This seemed a hybrid. Part of it is sort of like a radio drama. He's actually acting, serving as his own sound effects guy and using plastic water bottles and snack food bags to recreate sounds the way Foley men do on movies and radio dramas and talking.
I believe actually that some people have said it's meant to emulate a podcast, which is basically the same thing.
Yeah, radio.
And in fact, I even read something like that. This is the podcast crowd is really going to love this. Apparently, there are people who are specifically into going to see live recordings of podcasts. So I don't know if you knew that. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that in.
Yeah, they don't go for this kind of podcast. I actually do know that world, and they don't go for this kind of one.
Oh, okay. But, so no more about it than that.
But it part of it purports to show you how he's putting this oral experience together. And then the other part of it, he's as you say, running around the stage and acting out part of this hallucinatory story. And if there were other actors that he was interacting with, if we saw more of it, it might have been more enveloping, more inviting. The whole idea of the earphones, headphones, is to create the feeling of aloneness that he felt. Mm. However, I don't actually go to the theater to be alone. And so the whole sort of communal, we're all in this together experience of being in a theater was just fractured for me. And I admire Simon McBurney, as I think anyone who loves theater does. He's a true, I think, theater artist. And so I didn't have fault with him, but I found my mind wandering as I was sitting there with the headphones. Parts of the experience of hearing it at first when you're thinking, oh, is somebody behind me? That's fun during the first 5-10 minutes. And then it just sort of wears off and you're just kind of there. It didn't work for me at all.
Well, I will say it was a very weird experience not to have any sense of the audience, basically, because aside from everything, it's not there are very few laughs in it, I would say, to begin with. And even whatever laughs there are some scenes where he keeps breaking away to speak with his young daughter, who is in the next room while he's working on Simon McBurney. Well, for one issue is that he plays so many characters.
Yeah, it's really layered.
Yeah, not only himself and Lauren McIntyre and all of the people in the village, but then he keeps breaking away to have his daughter keeps waking up in the next room and coming in and wanting to be told a bedtime story or whatever.
Why was that there?
I thought it was there purposely because he felt that they needed to have breaks in the broader narrative. I don't know if I agree with that, but
I totally agree with what you're saying there, that he did that to break up the sections of the story. But I have to agree with what you both have said, and what Peter said in last week's podcast as well, was that this was an experiment gone awry, and that I'm shocked that it made it to the Broadway stage. I might have been better in a small off-Broadway house in a limited run, but bringing it into a commercial sphere like this, I felt it very theme parkish. Things that I have seen, at Disney, and I feel that it should have been, 45 minutes to an hour shorter. It was a tremendous amount of talent on the stage that perhaps is not best suited for this type of presentation. And I don't know. I don't know why, these gifted and talented Broadway producers who have a great depth of experience are interested in bringing this type of a show to Broadway, other than saying that there's one person on the stage, we can keep running costs really low and maybe make some money on this.
For what it's worth, some really excellent reviews, including the New York Times.
I want to give the producers credit for trying something different. We should have a variety of kinds of experiences on Broadway, and maybe, as Michael just said, I think Ben Brantley enjoyed it, and some of the other mainstream critics. But it just didn't, work for me, and I'm not sure it will work for the majority of audiences at these prices.
Mm. And, well, there's that issue too. Yes,
it started off at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and if it had been part of, for example, the Lincoln Center Festival that they do every summer, where they bring over really interesting, challenging works, that might have been interesting. If it had been
LCT3 or something like that, not a Broadway show.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that, and I don't object to the project per se. I do think it's interesting. I just thought that the storytelling got very muddled and it was longer than it needed to be.
All right. So why don't we all move forward into the next productions. Michael, you got a chance to see Daddy Issues at St. Clement's. So tell us about Daddy Issues.
Yes, if I may. Again, I don't want to offer a traditional review because I actually know the fellow in the lead role very well. His name is Matt Koplik, and he plays a fellow named Donald Moskowitz. And this play is it's written by Marshall Goldberg and directed by David Golden, and it's at the theater in St. Clement's. And I have a feeling that maybe it was written some time ago. It's set in the early 80s, and it's about a youngish gay man who's an aspiring actor who pretends to have a 10-year-old son in order to make his Jewish family happy. And I think there's a lot of comic possibilities there. But again, not to comment on the play itself, I did just want to say that although he is a friend of mine, Matt Koplik does something really amazing in this show, in that his role is basically that of a straight man, not in terms of sexual preference, but in terms of his part in the comedy. The other roles are mostly the ones with the jokes, and the other roles are the more colorful ones. But he mostly has to deliver straight lines and setups through much of the play, and to react to other people. But he does it so incredibly well that he actually winds up becoming the comic focus of the evening. And I think that's an extraordinary achievement. I haven't seen that too often. I don't think many plays are conceived that way. So that was really something from his that I think he deserves great credit for. And then also there's another lady in the cast who I have to single out. Her name is Allison Haley, and she plays Donald's friend Mary Ellen. And she too had such incredible comic timing that the audience was I felt like they really were in the palm of her hand. So that's pretty much what I'd like to say about Daddy Issues, and that's what I took away from it.
Okay, next up, Jan, you got down to MCC to see All the Ways to Say I Love You, which is playing at the Lucy Lortel. Peter talked about it last week, but what did you think about it?
I liked it, shorthand. This is a play. It's a one-person play by Neil LaBute, and it stars Judith Light, directed by Lee Silverman. Over the years, LaBute has he started off, let's go that with creating these really unpleasant characters who made people really uncomfortable and did things, said things that we wouldn't normally do. And starting with his breakthrough movie In the Company of Men, where there were these two men who just talked horribly about women. Might have been friends of Donald Trump. But over the years, his plays have, the characters in his plays have mellowed in a way. They're not just mean and in your face and saying people can do really bad things or wrong things. What he now does is to make these people more full-bodied, more complex. And in this play, the central character, the only character, is a school teacher, a woman whom we only know as Mrs. Johnson. And Mrs. Johnson talks directly to us, and she is confiding what has happened in her life. She's married. She's been married for a long time. They've not been able to have a child, to conceive a child. She loves her husband, but the marriage has sort of quieted down. She's no longer as certainly sexually interested in her husband as she was at the beginning of their marriage. She teaches high school, and into her class comes a young man, and she becomes attracted to him and starts an affair with him. And she's telling us this story in retrospect. And she knows that this is an incorrect thing to have done. She knew it at the time that it was an incorrect thing to do. And she explains to us, the play is about her explaining to us why and how she did it and what the consequences of doing it have been. And the consequences are very moving in the end. This is obviously a wonderful role for an actress, a middle-aged or older actress, and who better than Judith Light? I don't know. Judith Light, like read in the phone book or something, she'd be great. She just is speechless. I am about how she just exposes herself, her emotions, the emotions of the character she's playing. It's a very brief evening, just a little bit over an hour, but I found it an ultimately moving a piece of work.
Peter reflected very similar views last week and talked about Judith Light being one of the greats on Broadway that one should not miss.
On and off Broadway.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Michael, you got over to St. George Playhouse in Staten Island, is that it?
St. George Theater.
St. George Theater in Staten Island, where you saw the Midtown Men. So tell us about how are those boys doing?
Oh, they are doing really, really well. This was last night, October 8th. I went to the St. George Theater, which is I've spoken about before. In fact, I performed there about a year ago in a little Valentine's Day concert. But this was a much bigger deal than that. This was the Midtown Men, which they spoke during the show last night, and I believe they said this is their 11th year. This is a group that started out of alumni from the original cast of Jersey Boys, Daniel Ricard, Michael Longoria, J. Robert Spencer, and Christian Hoff. And they have this amazing act that has become incredibly popular, in which they do pop hits of the 60s, pop rock hits of the 60s. But within that, group of songs, the styles and the varied styles and types of music represented are really extraordinary. Everything from the Temptations to the Beatles to the Monkees and et cetera, on and on. And of course they do some of the Four Seasons, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, and they touch upon pretty much everything. But this group has really, the popularity has become extraordinary. They have had a PBS special all about them that was done at NJPAC, and they have two albums. They have a DVD. Well, it's the PBS special, and they one of them, I think it was Daniel, said from the stage that this is their seventh tour. And I'm not talking little sit downs in like two or three places each time. I'm talking about extensive tours. They were just amazing last night. This was actually the first full show of theirs that I had seen, not counting the PBS special. I had seen them perform a few numbers in various places before, but it's a two-act show and it just packed with music. They had an incredible seven-piece band, and at this point, I'm sure, you know, that from the beginning, they were really great and together and tight. But now, after all of these years of performing together, the choreography is so tight and so slick and so smooth. The harmonies are incredibly tight and phenomenal. And their patter is great. They really know how to work an audience. And they have that wonderful ability to when it comes to the singing and the choreography, to do things that they have done many, many times before and make it seem like they're really still in the moment and it's all very spontaneous and energetic. So I have to say it's one of the most entertaining shows I've seen in a long time. If you see them playing anywhere, go. They have been at the Beacon Theater not too long ago, and I think they've been there more than once, so you may see them there again. It really was just fantastic. And oh, another plus was that I actually bought a ticket because it was short notice, and I really wanted to see them with a friend of mine who's also a big fan. And so we wound up in the mezzanine, like the sixth row mezzanine at the St. George Theater, which in its day was a beautiful old vaudeville movie palace type place that originally had 3,000 seats. I think maybe that's been cut back somewhat, but it's got to be still, you know, well over 2,000. And it, I have to say, it's a really different experience to sit in the mezzanine, especially for a show like that. And I really love it. I don't know if a mezzanine is ideal for an intimate three-character play, but for a musical act, especially one with a great amount of energy, to be back a little further than the orchestra, you get more of a sense of the audience and the audience involvement, and you can see the ceiling of the beautiful theater, and it's just I'm going to have to try to sit in the mezzanine more often for things like that. I really, really love it.
Wow, that's great to hear. Before we run, you wanted to talk about an upcoming show called The Life Behind Bars at the United Solo Festival.
Yes, a friend of mine named Daniel Ruth, he was one of his most recent jobs was as the bartender at a restaurant called Mont Blanc on 48th Street in Hell's Kitchen, which closed quite a few months ago, is about to reopen on 52nd Street on the site of the old Bamboo 52. I'm not sure if Daniel will be back there, but anyway, I know him from the old location. And he, I feel like in a way I was in on the start of this show because he talked about it to me from the time that he started putting it together. And first of all, the first great thing about it is that the title is A Life Behind Bars, which, you know, is so clever. And you would think, well, some bartender sometime must have written a book or a show and called it A Life Behind Bars. Maybe they have, but this is the first one I know of. And it's really fantastic because there's the double meaning of the obviously behind a bar, you know, in a restaurant, or behind bars in prison, which in a way is what it can sometimes feel like. This show, he did it previously in Williamsburg last year, and I saw it, and it was absolutely great. I mean, you meet someone in a different context. I had no idea how it would be. I wanted to go to support him. I wasn't necessarily expecting anything that great. It was really one of the best solo shows I've seen in terms of the writing and the acting. And it's gotten some great reviews. Let's see. Sifter said a tour de force performance. Bedford and Bowery said, "Crawl into the gutter, a depiction of life in the service industry that any bartender patron can relate or patron can relate to." And the tagline for the show is Dan Ruth's hysterical, darkest pitch comedy about tending bar in New York City. A life behind bars shows what can happen when you reach for the stars but grab for the bottle instead. So it's going to be at Theater Row on October 20th at 9 p.m. as part of the United Solo Festival, and I highly recommend it if you can get a ticket. Tickets, $20.25.
All right. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Peter is traveling, and we couldn't record his trivia segment ahead of time, so we will get back to that next week. But before I leave, I want to remind listeners that you could subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. This is a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us many ways. iHeartRadio, Google Play, anywhere that you can listen to finer podcasts, you can get Broadway Radio, as well as the Stitcher app. And Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for all of us can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Jan Simpson, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Without you I die, dear, knowing I love you so. Anyone who had a heart would take me in her arms and love me too. You couldn't really have a heart and hurt me like you hurt me and be so untrue. Anyone who had a heart would love me too, yeah. Anyone who had a heart would surely take me in her arms and always love me. Why won't you?